Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we have Frank Blanquette in conversation with Sean Michael Perry. Perry was on an early KVC Arts talking about his music and acting. More tonight as Perry has a role in No Time to Run, a film released recently through Vimeo on demand. More at notimetorun.com. Also tonight, Katie McLean. You may have seen her recently on KVCR-TV with her film Seeing is Believing, Women Direct. She may be best known as an actress, having appeared on many commercials when she wasn't even yet a teenager. She's probably more well known in the world of soap operas. KVCR's Lillian Vasquez has more.
Katie McLean is a director, producer, a writer, author, and actor. Many of you may know her from years as Dixie Cooney Martin on All My Children or Roseanne Cabot Montgomery on As the World Turns. But you're also a director, a producer, an artist, and writer. You've written a memoir, Katie McLean, Murdering My Youth. Now, I just have to say, the cover of the photo and the title of your book speak volumes. Your book covers a challenging and dysfunctional family. Your father abandoned you, your mother was troubled, and your sister wasn't always the older sister you needed her to be.
That's true. But, you know, I have grown to really have so much more love and compassion for the whole scenario. You know, when you're the youngest in the family, and I was, I think there was a natural, you know, tendency for me to say, you know, why are y'all not taking care of me? What's going on?
Sure.
And as I've gotten older and I'm able to look back, I can say, oh, well, that's why. There were very deep troubles going on with my mom and dad. And, you know, that affected my sister and me. And we did our best to survive it and did.
I think that's all you can do as a child is try and survive it. And it sounds like you did and came out on the other end. So I wanted to ask, you started acting at an early age and quickly became the breadwinner of your family when both your parents had law degrees. How was
right.
that for you?
I know. What was going on there, indeed? The story is that my mom was very smart, and she got her law degree in order to encourage my father to get his, like, out of spite. Who gets their law degree out of spite? Like, it's just ridiculous. But she truly felt she had an ingrained idea that women could not be in positions of authority in this world and would be destroyed if they tried, and that over 40, they were invisible and no longer valued or seen by the culture. She literally showed me an article from Newsweek magazine that said, and you can Google this and search it and find it, you have as much a chance as getting killed by a terrorist as you do of getting married over 40, if you're a woman.
Wow.
In the early 80s. That's what Newsweek was putting out there.
Oh.
And that's really screwed up for Newsweek to be putting that out there about women as a quote-unquote statistic, showing no... Where was this study done? Who did this study? People say, you know, it's ridiculous. It's a terrible thing to say when there are plenty of women that are living completely opposite truth. But that was her experience and her, you know, the message she got from her young life and her growing up was that it was brutally hard to be a woman and you better do as well as you can as a young woman and just make the most of the opportunities and suck it up, basically, because things ain't changing.
Your first commercial as a little girl, what was it and do you still remember the lines?
Oh, yeah. It was the I'm Stuck on Band-Aids, you know.
Do you remember the jingle?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm stuck on Band-Aids because Band-Aids stuck on me.
Was that one of your first commercials? Was that, you know, did that kind of launch your child career?
Yeah. I mean, I had been doing some little community plays. I was a ham. I loved acting and singing. And I had a friend in a tap class who's was doing commercials, and I was competitive, and I wanted to do that. And I think also, too, my mind kind of was putting together our financial struggles, and this girl was making money, and I could make money. I liked selling my Girl Scout cookies in front of the Safeway, I've always had this thing in my head of like, how hard can it be? How hard can it be? Sort of ridiculous
That's
naivete,
funny.
If you will, but it
That's
has
funny.
Served me well, oddly enough. And so I said to my mom I wanted to do commercials, and she sent out this ridiculous-looking headshot that had been printed backwards in black and white with stage makeup on. And yet this child's agent called up my mom and our family and said, I want to see her, and then she liked me, you know. And she turned out to be quite a personality in the business. Iris Burton was a pretty tough cookie. And yet I booked. I had this strength, and she had this thing about kids with strength. And she saw the strength in me and said, you can do this. And I could. And I could.
And you did.
And I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your parents didn't save the money you were making as a child. They kind of capitalized on your income as legalese. That they should have known about the Coogan Law, right?
Yes, they should have. That speaks to my mom's naivete. I think, however, she was desperate. Our fluctuating income was really nightmarish. You know, there were times that the lights would go off and we would be breaking open piggy banks and rushing to the Con Ed to pay the light bill.
Wow.
I mean, we wouldn't have to spend the evening with candles. I mean, and it was all because my dad was an alcoholic and he was spending every dime on suits and cars and meals and, you know, whatever else he was doing. It's really kind of classic alcoholism, if you will. Like, now that I've studied that a fair amount, you think to yourself as a quote-unquote normalish person, you think, like, how is that possible for a man to, like, spend all of his family's money? And, you know, alcoholics,
right. Yeah, of course.
They're not really thinking that much. They're drinking a lot, but they're not thinking a lot.
Yeah. Let me ask about the auditioning as a little girl. I have a daughter, and when she was 5, I wanted to get her to do some commercials so we could save money for her college. I thought if we did it for a couple of years, she'd make a few thousand dollars, and we'd put it away and save it for her college tuition. And then I took her to a couple of the auditions, and I hated the way she felt afterwards. We only did 3, and I said, I'm done. I cannot have this affect my daughter in a negative way, not thinking that she's as good as all the other girls there, and I couldn't do it. And, you know, I must say, I did get some headshots out of it that I absolutely cherish today, but how is it for you as a little girl?
Well, I recommend that people do not put their children into show business, mainly because you learn very quickly as a child that you are a product.
Right.
And that your feelings actually don't matter, and that it's a very adult environment, that they have the right to have it be an adult environment. This is not playtime. This is not kiddie hour. This is a job. This is a work, and you are expected to be a professional.
Wow.
So you grow up really fast if you get into show business, and the competition is incredibly harsh, and even other little girls aren't necessarily particularly, or boys, you know, aren't particularly friendly towards you because you're the competition. The only way to survive it, I've seen, there's a few people that I know that have been child actors that have survived it, and they're either in situations where the work environment that they were in was very supportive of them being a child, and they were getting some support emotionally
right.
from the people that they worked with for their childlikeness and their need to be a child, or they were going to a professional children's school where there were other children around them, and they were being able to talk and have that conversation with them to say, oh, that's normal for me too. That's my normal. And so they don't feel so strange. But it does take some kind of community to help support that so they don't feel like a complete outsider. I mean, by the time I was 19 years old, it was very hard for me to relate to people my age because I'd already had 10 years of huge professional and successful experience. The kind of stuff that a 20 to 30 year old would have been happy with as a career. So I always have had much more connection with people who are about 10 years older than me because of the kind of breadth of experience that I've had.
Yeah. You grew up quickly for sure.
Yeah.
In your career as an actress, you were certainly familiar with and what we now refer to as the Me Too movement. You wrote in your book that you were traumatized by your acting experience as a child and adolescent.
Well, you know, there were experiences that all had to do with either my body or my sexuality. And you know, just being a young girl, you know, 16 years old, there are people who will think that that's very attractive and respond to you in a way that is not acknowledging your innocence, your naivete. And that was a new, you know, I had to get the heck out of L.A., let's just put it that way. Uh-huh. I had to get out of L.A., and it was like, I call it like shark chum, you know.
Jeez.
As a little kid, I could kind of handle the certain kind of weirdness occasionally.
Right.
I felt more heavily protected by, like, the wardrobe ladies or makeup ladies or casting people or whatever that were. I was sort of buffered by a lot of people. But as I got older, that buffering waned, and I was, quote-unquote, on my own, and then it was not good. Because there's a lot of creepy people in show business. You know, it's like moths to the light, you know? There's a lot of light here. So at 16, I realized I just couldn't handle it. And so I got a play that brought me to New York, and I begged my mom to move us there. Because somehow or other, I could move in New York a little more anonymously and privately, and there just wasn't so much focus on show business.
Well, speaking of your mom, you experience a lot of heartache from your mother, as you've written in the book. But what did you learn from your mom?
Oh, I learned a lot of things. You know, I learned compassion. She had a great sense of humor. I mean, she was crazy, but she was hilarious. I learned what not to do in a lot of scenarios.
Okay.
She tended to go for the drama wherever possible and turn up the heat on it as opposed to turning it down. She had a lot of buttons about, like, fight, you know. She would spring into a hot fight rather than, like, how do I diffuse this conflict? How do I come to understanding? I mean, I think what I appreciate most from my life with her and my time with her is her love of the arts and her ability to sort of saturate herself in her artistic life and just get so much from that, just personally. Like, I know now that if I turn to my artistic work, I can find joy and satisfaction. I don't have to, like, get it from anywhere else but from the conversation I have with whatever's happening on a piece of paper in front of me.
Yeah, when I was reading and I looked on your website and I saw the art aspect, I very much saw that you must have had some of that from the genes of your mother and her love of art. But you did write, you wrote a positive comment about your mom on page 144 that really struck me, and it was, and I quote, "Sometimes she truly did not suck." And I thought, that was the best thing you could write.
I love that expression.
I did too, and that's why I'm talking about it. It's because I thought when I read that, I went back and I read it a couple of times, and I'm like, okay, so sometimes you truly didn't suck. So that must have been a time when she maybe gave you some positive feedback or some input.
Oh my God, it's so funny. She wasn't that kind of person, you know? I mean, I think I do recall one. It was very rare. The compliments came very sparingly. And I think that was partly a kind of a Protestant upbringing where, you know, to praise is to court someone thinking too much of themselves. So you weren't given a lot of that, like, good job, you know, well done, you can do it. You just got the nod and say, okay, great. Now what? But she did leave a message on my answering machine at work one time when she saw some work that I did and on all my children, and said something very beautiful about being proud of me, and I'll always remember that.
Yep, those are the nice ones, aren't they?
Yeah.
So I really liked, you know, we're an NPR station. Our sister station is our PBS station. And I was really, it made me laugh that you mentioned PBS in your book. Why were you watching PBS as a teenager? Nobody watches PBS as a teenager.
I don't know. I mean, back in when I was a teenager, there were only a few channels to choose from.
Sure.
And no internet. And so a lot of times PBS was just more interesting. I mean, I have to say it was just much, you know, it wasn't always like super highbrow, but it was talking about life and talking about people and talking about what was really going on. You know, I have great respect and admiration and appreciation for PBS and what it brought to my life. It brought the world to me. You know, the world was so much more than. And I think possibly because of the incredible stress that we were having at home, I needed to know what else was out there. I had a higher focus on what was, instead of focusing on what was quote-unquote popular at the time or what my friends were watching or any of that, I needed to know that there was a better and bigger world out there. And so PBS provided that.
Nice. Boy, we need to get you on a pledge drive where you make that pitch and maybe people will donate.
Sure, I'll do it in a minute.
You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Later in the program, we'll have FNX's Frank Blanquette in conversation with actor and musician Sean Michael Perry. Right now, though, back to Lillian Vasquez in conversation with Katie McLean, actress, director, author, and more.
All right, so you've moved to New York. You left Southern California, actually grew up in Orange County, and you maybe a little bit of LA County as well, and then you moved to New York. You talk your mom into letting you take this job. You just mentioned you kind of like New York and it escaped the LA market. Your first screen test in New York for Guiding Light, do you recall it and how it went?
Vividly. I can feel the sweat. As I can think back from that moment, it was dripping down my back and the dust motes floating in front of my eyes and no words coming from my mouth and the cameras rolling and I was frozen. I just couldn't think of a thing. Oh. And the face of the other actor who was going, Katie, you know, I just completely bonked. Yeah, it was bad.
Did you think that your career was over, or did you know you still had it in you to give it another try?
Oh, man. I mean, thank goodness I think I was 16 at the time.
Oh, good.
I knew I had my life ahead of me. You know, I had to keep trying. And I knew I had to keep trying because, you know, we were broke.
Right.
And my mom couldn't really provide for us, and there was no option. There was no, oh, you could go to school or you could do this. There was no option. So I had to just get my act together and figure out how to overcome my fear or else we were not going to survive.
Wow, what a lot to carry on such a young person. But Dixie Cooney Martin changed your life. You won Emmy Awards and you thanked your colleagues when you accepted your award and how much you loved them and appreciated them. Tell me how Dixie Cooney Martin changed your life.
Boy, a lot of ways. You know, I met amazing people, and I continue to meet amazing people. The work that I did continues to resonate, which is incredible, and I'm so grateful for that. You know, that show has been over for, I think, 10 years or so now. In the short moment, in the early days, it provided security, stability. I was able to rent a home for my mom and my family and, you know, just provide the thing that we had not had since my dad left and probably even before he left because everything was always so crazy when he was around. So that was the great gift of that job and the money that came from that job was being able to help stabilize everything. And yeah, it couldn't solve the problems of my family and it couldn't fix everything,
sure.
You know?
Right. But it sure did help, huh?
It certainly helped. And I was able to help educate myself a little bit more with that, the funds that work came with, and travel, find out more about the world, get some therapy.
So I want to dive.
All that good stuff.
I want to dive in a little bit more, if you can, if you'll indulge me. Your character Dixie and Tad Martin, played by Michael Knight, and he was quite a character. Can you share a little bit more about your role than that, and your relationship with either Tad or with Michael Knight?
Mike and I were always great friends. I think in the early days, you know, when you play a character day after day, and your character is falling in love, you know, you kind of wonder, like, am I falling in love with this person, you know? But it was never, we were always very clearly friends, and there was always a line, and we always cared very much about each other. And, you know, we fought a fair amount, but we were usually fighting about the work and sometimes how we were treating each other and around, you know, regarding the work, who was tired, who needed to be listened to, who, you know, had to have their say. And but one of the great things I'm so grateful for is that Mike really liked to kind of mess around with the script, and the writers allowed us to do that. And you know, we would never change the plot. We would never change the structure of the script, but we would occasionally break it apart and change it so that we would be able to drop into our characters a little bit more or add some humor. And so we spent a lot of time writing, too. So I think that was a great part of our relationship, and a super fun part of what came out of that for me was learning about writing and how to continue to serve the story through the writing, which was great.
Well, thank you. You married later in life, and you haven't been married a number of times, like Erica Kane. you married a handsome actor from another soap, John Lindstrom. And how did you meet, and how did you know that he was the right man for you?
That's a great question. I love talking about John. So funny. So, yes, I kind of swore that I would never marry somebody and have a marriage like my parents. Their marriage was so rock and roll. It was so get together, break up, you know. They were so much in love and it was so much drama. And when whatever relationship I was in seemed to head towards that kind of scenario, I would just be like, I'm out. So I knew that I needed somebody who was going to be more stable. And I remember when John and I first started working together, we were just friends. I was with someone that was heading into the rock and roll territory. And I thought, gosh, I wish I could just meet somebody like John. He's so great. He's just like the kind of person I want to be with. We can talk about things. He's like very adult. You know, he's fun. And this little voice said, you know, he's sitting right next to you, you jerk.
Really?
Wake up. He's sitting right next to you. That's the guy. He's the one. So it was just like that. And I think I turned to him and said the most strange thing. I said, you know, if you were in a hospital, I would come and take care of you. And he gave me the strangest look, like, that's the weirdest thing anybody I've worked with has ever said to me. Wow, okay. But it turns out that he had been growing in his feelings for me as well. And it kind of just sort of started from that, you know. And we've been together almost, it'll be 10 years this fall, yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. Why did you write the book? The words feel so very honest in it when I read it. Why did you write it?
I felt like, well, first of all, I had not been acting, and I wanted to write. I enjoyed writing, and I started writing in third. This whole story in third person. I had no intention of making this a story about I, and here's the story of me and my life and my family. And I wrote the entire book in third person with fictional names. And I had a friend who is a writer and a teacher of writing at UConn, Davine Verstandig, who's an amazing human being who I will always be grateful to for her support around this book, say, you know, this might be more impactful if you put it in first person. Why don't you give it a try on a chapter?
Wow.
And I had someone who was actually, you know, a literary agent type who was saying, yes, I'd like this book better if you did it that way, too. So I redid the whole book, and it was excruciatingly painful.
I mean, it was
so very hard to put that this amount of honesty forward. But here's the thing. I really, really believe that there are a lot of people who've lived the same stuff I have. Some of the stuff I've been through has been kind of extraordinary because of show business. And that kind of maybe adds a magical element to it all. But the basic bones of it is a kind of family dysfunction that is unfortunately very common.
Right.
And the loneliness that I felt living with that was so painful. I thought if anybody else is harboring this kind of sorrow, then I need to use the strength that I have as a person to be brave enough to put this out there so that I am no longer living with it alone, and other people don't have to feel so alone. This is a human experience. We're all having these sort of radically human experiences, and there's more that we can get from it when we share them.
Right. You had a journal, or maybe you had more of several of them, but one of them was titled My Dreams. How old were you when you wrote these thoughts, and are you fulfilling some of those dreams at this point in your life?
That's a lovely question. I have a lot of journals. I have boxes of them. And that, I think I started as a little kid, but then I really picked it up in my early 20s because I didn't know what to do with the painful feelings that I was having. And, you know, whether I was writing poetry or my feelings or my hopes or, you know, I'd heard that if you, you know, the creative visualization, if you dreamed about it, you could perhaps someday accomplish it. And, you know, I think my life now is sort of beyond my wildest dreams. I never imagined I would do a film, a documentary film.
Nice.
Never. About women directors? Never. That was never like an early 20s or in my teens did I even imagine that was something, a conversation that I would be having with people.
Here's some of the things you wrote. I want to go to college. I want to be normal. I want to have friends who like me because they like me and not because I'm on television. I want to learn how to cook. I want to fall in love and be happy. Mm. I want a nice family. I want to feel beautiful and drive a cool little car. I want to be free. I want to be loved. I want to be left alone.
Mm. I remember that.
Do you?
Yeah. I got a lot of those. I'd like to say like it's like an 8 out of 10 kind of thing.
Pretty good.
I've gotten better about being left alone, but you know, I'm not acting all as much as I used to. You know, acting is, you get picked up, you get picked at, you get a lot of spiciness being thrown at you, like a lot. So that's kind of the pleasure of not acting, is not having to deal with some of that stuff.
You also wrote, I want to be an artist, a writer, a painter, and a burlesque dancer. I think you've got some of those down too. The artist, the writer, the painter. I don't know about the burlesque dancer.
And I regret not doing the burlesque. I really do. I missed out on that one. That would have been fun, you know? Maybe one of these days. I admire them so much. I think it's such a cool, cool gig.
Katie, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. Katie McLean is a director, a producer, an artist, an actor, and a writer. Thank you so much for your time. It's just been great for me.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you talking about the book. It means a lot to me, you know. That book means it's my life.
So, it is.
Thank you.
That was KVCR's Lillian Vasquez in conversation with Katie McLean. More on McLean, her memoir, and more at katiemclean.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Find many past KVC Arts programs via podcast through iTunes, NPR One, and Spotify. And most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. Let's go now to Frank Blanquette with a piece originally seen on FNX Now, with another recent film, one of the actors involved, and some of his music as well.
Ba'ash Kawalik, I'm Frank Blanquette. Welcome to FNX Now. The COVID-19 pandemic took its toll on this country in 2020. Countless lives were lost, jobs were lost, and businesses were severely impacted. Amongst those industries were the television and film industry. Many productions came to a halt, and those films slated to be released in theaters were forced to postpone their releases or found alternative outlets that included Netflix, Amazon, and HBO Max, to name a few. But whether it was a major release or an independent film, promotion for these productions in the form of film festivals was non-existent. Today, we will take a look at a feature film that has been released online via Vimeo On Demand. The film is titled No Time to Run, and we are being joined by one of its stars, Sean Michael Perry. Let's take a look at a clip of the film.
Woman I know, even if you don't know it.
Your voice has reached across time and space back to us. Do not underestimate yourself.
When was the last time you did anything for your city? When was the last time you did anything for your country?
I'm a runner. I run away from every challenge I've ever faced.
Wield your voice. It's the most powerful weapon you possess.
That looks intense. Sean Michael Perry, welcome to the show.
Hello, everybody. How are you? Frank's good to see you.
Good to see you too. And Sean, can you introduce yourself? Tell us your tribal affiliation and a bit about yourself. You were a musician first and got into acting, or what did you first pursue? What was your first passion?
Sure. I am born in San Diego, Chula Vista. My mother is a Maya like you and Ketchin ancestry. And I've never met my true father. I was adopted by a Swedish man. Adopted into a family and didn't know much about my cultural background until we moved up into Idaho and Montana and touched some roots up there with relatives and whatnot, frankly, around the Flathead Indian Reservation. I am not Flathead. I am not a descendant, but I am very woven into the fabric there in some degree. Went to school in Missoula, Montana for high school and college. Have a lot of good friends up on the Flathead. And I also have my son, who I have with a Flathead Salish woman, who lives there with my two grandchildren. So I'm also connected in that way. As a youngster, just really was into music and acting and dancing at a very young age. Lived in Guam for a while when my father was in the Navy. And I saw Michael Jackson on the Flip Wilson show. And I had to beg my dad, oh, I got to stay up to see this. It was like 8 o'clock at night. And I got to see it and it was like, oh my, that's what I want to do. And then some years later, you know, through school and especially in high school in Missoula, got into the choir, got into the drama department. Always had a yearning for it. Then we jumped to the University of Montana, and I'm going to school there, and I'm watching these two actors that performed in a lot of the plays at the time there. One of the names I'll drop is Renee Haynes, who went to school there and was one of the best actors I've ever seen, and who now is one of our greatest casting directors in the Native American film and television department.
You were in a band, Only the Brave. Can you talk to us about the music career that you developed for yourself?
Of course. So what really spurned my music career, not only telling you about Michael Jackson, watching him on television, that was cool. But really, I'll be real honest with you. When we were living in Montana, Redbone and Buffy St. Marie and Floyd Westerman and it'll come to me, the last guy, Buddy Redbone. All came and performed in Missoula and I got to see it. And then afterwards they came to my house. Now I'm a young guy at the time. Right. And I was like, wow, now talk about a band that can perform. Now, I mean, Redbone was, the other groups were great. And I could tell you stories about them too, because I've had relationships with them, if you will, in one way or another, but I will stick to Redbone because they enticed me the most. So, wow. I've never seen people do that on stage. I never seen Native American guys do that on stage. And it wasn't campy. It wasn't, it was musical prowess. I mean, these guys could really get down, man. And the reason I knew that is because I'm watching the crowd and the men and the women are dancing around like spring just came. Never seen nothing like it. To this day, I've been to a lot of concerts and I've seen people sway and I've seen people do certain things, but not how Redbone got people to do things. The whole unison thing, the whole love thing. It was amazing. I'm really, really thankful I got to see that when I was young and even as I got older. Pat Vegas is still alive and his son is doing great things also, PJ. What an interesting world I grew up in and was able to be a part of, to be able to rock out with those guys. And so it taught me a lot about songwriting. Taught me a lot about how to be a great musician, or at least, maybe I shouldn't say great, but at least aspire to be that, if you will, eh? And I was able to play with a lot of great musicians because of that and met a lot of great musicians. So as we get up into after graduating from school, and then I met a guy named Kurt James, who was the second guitarist for Steeler, the band that most rockheads would know as the Yngwie Malmsteen band. Yngwie Malmsteen is one of the greatest guitar players ever, but I'll put my guy, Kurt James, up against him any day. Kurt James just recently just got done touring with Graham Bonnet. And Graham Bonnet was in a few bands, Alcatraz to be one of them. So some of you older people that are listening will definitely know who that is. Graham Bonnet, one of the greatest singers ever. Look him up. And so my friend, guitarist Kurt James, played with him. And we had a band called Only the Brave and a band called Snagglepuss back in the day in Orange County. And our music, we were very influenced by Jimi Hendrix and Edward Van Halen. And then if we want to talk about, you know, the blues elements of music too, big, big influence of me too, John Lee Hooker. So every time I heard something growing up, NPR actually is a great source of hearing diverse music. And I heard a lot of it growing up. So that was really influential in the music making, if you will.
You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming. We're streaming live at kvcrnews.org, and you can find many past KVC Arts programs via podcast through iTunes, NPR One, and Spotify, and most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Back now to Sean Michael Perry. This is a conversation originally seen on FNX Now, talking about the recent film No Time to Run, released through Vimeo On Demand. More at notimetorun.com. Perry is one of the actors in the film, but tonight we're hearing about some of his music as well. Once again, here's Frank Blanquette, producer with FNX.
Pretty much you could find all kinds of old videos on YouTube, and I want to play a clip from Only the Brave, the Forever video.
Cold outside, oh, it's cold to the touch. Are you willing to work things out? Me, myself, and I are for one and one for all. That's when I start to cry, ooh, Lord, while I try.
So Sean, what can you tell us about that video? Does that bring back some memories?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, you know, I wrote that song a while ago. One of my first songs that I wrote on the piano. And it came about where I went to Hollywood. And I looked up my buddy, John Avila, who is in the band Oingo Boingo. And since then has produced many great records. And I said, hey, you know, I got this idea for this tune. And I just, you know, I'm not quite sure how to phrase it or whatnot. So anyway, long story short, he helped me make the song. And I was like, wow, it came out great. So I was like, well, we better put a video to it. And I didn't have really any money. You know, I kind of spent all the dough on the recording, you know. So I thought to myself, at the time I was living in Flagstaff, and I knew this kid named Patrick, and his dad was head of the media department up there in Northern Arizona University of Northern Arizona, one of those two. And so I was able to rent a camera, and then I had a little video camera of my own. And I had Patrick, the son, come out. Yowl is his last name, Patrick Yowl. And I had him come out and run the big camera, you know, for the big shots. And I used the handheld, you know, for some of the other things. And we just went for it. And that's all just like the first takes. And luckily, I found a young man that was really good in the editing room. I think that's where it all happens. That's where the magic happens. And so he put it together really well, and I was able to pay him for that, and that all worked out. So that's how that came about. My first effort at doing anything like that, I thought it came out pretty good. Obviously, it could be better, could have had this, that, or the other. But for what it was, I think it was pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. What year did that come out?
Yeah, that was 2008.
Wow.
Yeah, so 12 years ago.
That's a great song. It's a really, really cool song.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. So just back to that, the new song I'm doing is also driven by the piano. And I wrote this one for my wife. And I'll get you a snippet of it down the road, eh? But I'm hoping to get it out for Valentine's Day. But it's We Must All Stand Together. Boy, do we need to do that right now, huh?
Yeah, absolutely.
As people. So interesting, you know, kind of went full circle here with the music because that was my first tune. And then now this one. And that still gets lots of hits and I still sell it. So that's another thing. I think, you know, those who want to write their music and, you know, just really be yourself and be adamant about what you want in your songs, but always communicate and take good critique, just like in acting, very important.
So we opened the show with a clip from No Time to Run. You are one of the leading cast members in this film. You play a co-talker's great grandson. Can you talk to us a little bit about the character you play and about the film?
Yeah. Howie Bridgewater is his name. And his great-grandfather in World War II was a co-talker from the Pawnee people. And it's so cool because obviously, you know, my look takes that understanding a long ways without even having to say anything. So in the script, I was able to look at the lines, especially when it came to the Native American parts of it, if you will, you know, for sensitivity, for saying something that we would say as opposed to another race of people, how they might look at something, right? So what I liked about it was that there wasn't too much fudging, if you will, to do. There was a few things that I thought was more of a third person look than an individual saying it and living it and breathing it. So you obviously notice that I'm, you know, I've got long hair and I'm, you know, I am who I am. And as we gradually get into the movie, we talk about that. And so she has a big problem with her father, who's Herman Cain, who passed away, unfortunately. And living up to his expectations, his model, his civic duty, et cetera. And I identified with the character because my father was in the service. But for us in particular, in the Native American cinema world, that's why I chose to do this film, because we don't have very many parts like that as a group or individuals, i.e. a mainstream part that this guy just happens to be Native American. And look how many other facets he has, a family man, a business owner, a father, a community driver and member. These things that I think that we have lost sight of as a nation. So with No Time to Run, it's the premise is about a young Black woman and her family. And her father is the mayor of this small town in Missouri. And things are going okay, but, you know, she's kind of giving this, you know, she's not sure where she is in her life, if you will, at this point in time. Her son's getting ready to go to college. Her husband's always been a real laid back guy, you know, definitely on point when he needs to be, but pretty laid back. So she's questioning life. And as we get through the film, we meet one of the senators that's involved with this petition, if you will, to do some changes in America that might not be right for the individual or the group of people. And I remind her, you know, throughout the film, even with I have a little, I guess a proverb or an elegy, if you will. I state a little story to her and she kind of just says, oh, that's ridiculous, you know, at the time, but it really makes sense towards the end of the film. And so I didn't have to stretch too far to be an actor in this, because I really felt like it was me anyway. I really did. I grew up in a lot of these circumstances. I believe in the flag. I believe in our country. I understand many things have happened to, especially to Native American people. They've been through the gauntlet and back, and you know, and just like the Black man or the Asian man or anybody else that had their somebody step on them, if you will, we're sick of it. We don't need it anymore. Look beyond me. You said I was deep earlier. You darn right I am. And the reason I am is because We all are. And we can't be superficial every day of our life. We have a wealth and a well of knowledge within us that needs to be applied, whether you know it or not. It's part of how the world goes around. So I was able to do that in this film. And I was able to be the rock. Not a big, hard, smashing rock with a wave smashing against it, but more of a rock that's in the middle of a river or a stream. And I was able to guide my wife, Melanie, in this film to do the right thing. And I was really proud of that, because what do we see in a lot of communities in Native America? We don't see anything like that. Good marriages, children going to college. I could go on and on. Now, that doesn't mean it doesn't happen. Of course it does. But because of media, which we're both in, we see the ugly side of things a lot in our reservations and not the good things as much. So another opportunity to show, hey, this guy can work. He doesn't have to drink. He doesn't have to be a fool. He has a son that's going to college, valedictorian in high school. Hey, that's America to me. And no matter how hard it is for you, you can do better. You really can. I believe that. I believe that. I believe that. And that's what America's all about. And I'm sorry I'm tooting that horn all the time, but this is all we got. I'm not going to move somewhere else and think it's going to get better. I'm not going to go out into outer space and think it's going to get better. This is it. So I want to do the best that I can. And I want to do roles in films and sing songs about the best of us and not the worst of us.
And you know, it's a serious film. It touches base on history. It has time travel in it. You're a time traveler in it.
Yeah. Wow. So the whole thing with Ben Franklin, you got to do some research into history to really get this film. But that harmonica that is used for time travel is a real device. And there are real questions about what was it really used for. So that's really cool. The fact that this woman's family is interwoven into the fabric of America like that is very cool. And we have a woman embracing George Washington in this film. A little controversial at this point in time. Some people want to tear down his statues because he was a slave owner. But if you really pay attention to this film, we it's over a hamburger of all things, which is light. But she really puts a dagger in him about being accountable for being a slave owner. And I think that took moxie on the writer's part and her part to deliver that in such a way. And that is a great question. Wow, well, how come you didn't do nothing about it? What? So nobody's perfect. Was it wrong? Yes, it was. Did he get rid of all of his slaves? Did he sell them? Did he let them into freedom at the end of their whatever it was with his agreement? As far as I understand in the history books, yes, he did. Did he profit off that? I don't know. But are things that we got to address. We have to talk about these things. Father of our country, maybe debatable. Maybe. I mean, we look at who's in power now, and if that's my father, man, I'm going to run. But you know, these words are important. You know, like I said, the father. I mean, you know, the composure that a man or woman holds in high office, for example, it's very important because we are all watching, and leaders are important, very important. And so, I think another aspect of this film, and being able to go back in time, was to maybe bring up some of that discussion. And I would love this film to be shown in schools and whatnot, because it brings up discussion. I'm not asking you to believe one way or another in any of it, but it's, except for one part, which would be the family ideal, the American citizen, the cultural citizen. I think those points got across in the film, and I'm proud.
Absolutely. And, you know, it was a learning experience for me because, as you said, I did not know that that film was that instrument actually existed. But one of the other things is I was not aware that at one point George Washington freed his slaves towards the end of his life. And that is something that's a very intense speech that she gives to him at the close of the film. So,
yeah,
so I'm glad you bring that up. Absolutely.
Well, it's important because it's in people's hearts and minds right now. You know, our next president has a lot to do and a lot to try to accomplish. But again, it's back to basics. If you kind of want to compartmentalize it, you know, as we as people, we have to, you know, common sense is common sense. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to have it. So I just think people need to pause and think about all the great things, you know, like watching FNX, for example. Wow. Innovative, free, that we as a society are able to do these things. Where the future is.
And the idea is because, you know, us as Native communities, we don't have representation in media to the extent that other communities do. And so trying to offer this channel and make it as accessible to everybody is part of our mandate, you know. And I mean, mm-hmm. Sadly, like we're from a lot of communities, you know, like we're south of the border Native, you know, that's what I am. My family's Maya. We couldn't really afford cable or any type of paid subscription service. And so having a free channel that offers us representation, you know, as it is for a lot of tribes across the country that either don't have, you know, cable companies servicing their reservations or their areas that they live in, or it's, you know, it's just that if they did, they wouldn't be able to afford it. You know, having a free over the air broadcast channel is huge to us. And that's what we strive for.
I've seen some great things on it over the years. And well, I guess probably the main thing I'm glad about is that you still are here. We've had other things that have come and gone and great ideas, but you know, no stability, no foundation. And I'm so happy about that. You know, we look at our brothers and sisters in Canada, you know, they really got it going on when it comes to television and film and so on and so forth. And I know that we can do that too. It's just convincing the upper echelon in Hollywood and those that have the purse strings, if you will, that this is a necessity as more than an extra. And I know a lot of young people in our world today, you know, they need that embrace. They need to know that is there for them. And again, we could go on and on about education, you know, why isn't the channel in every school or in every reservation? Why isn't, you know, I could go on and on. So we have to talk about those things.
Yeah. Well, Sean, thank you for visiting with us. We're out of time. Really, really appreciate you being on FNX Now today.
You bet. Thank you so much. And thank you to all of you. It's been a real pleasure.
That was actor and musician Sean Michael Perry in conversation with Frank Blanquette, producer with FNX. More at fnx.com, seanmichaelperry.com, and more on the film once again at notimetorun.com. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Sean Michael Perry and Katie McLean. At FNX, thanks to Frank Blanquette. And here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, and Shireen Awad. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, NPR One, and Spotify. And most past shows, including one with Sean Michael Perry, at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year. Just go to kvcrnews.org/support. And thanks again.